The Senate voted early this morning to pass a $1.3 trillion spending bill to fund the government through September 3rd that avoided a government shutdown. The massive spending package easily passed in both the House and the Senate. It's up for discussion on Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the table this week, it's Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Steve, welcome back.
Good morning from the part of the state that is about to be covered in snow. And if I had to indicate my opinion about that, you would lose your license for the FCC, so I won't.
And Matt Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Matt, welcome back to you.
Hey, Kate, thanks for having me back on. Good morning, Steve.
Well, let's dig right in. The $1.3 trillion budget bill will substantially boost military and domestic spending. It also includes some funding for President Trump's proposed border wall with Mexico. Does not address the DACA program. Steve, let's start with you. Is this a good deal for America?
Once upon a time, I read someplace where nothing good is ever accomplished after midnight, and I believe the final vote on this was somewhere
12:55-ish.
Yeah, and that's really my opinion about this. It is frankly obscene to spend $1.3 trillion, but this is also the logical result of what happens when you pass a budget to avert a manufactured fiscal crisis in an election year. No, I'm not a supporter of this. In any sense, I think that we not only spend too much money, but we spend too much money in the wrong places. I'm not even certain that I would support the defense funding increases. I'm not a supporter of the border wall. So I don't support
$78 billion increase in military spending over the 2017 levels, $52 billion increase for domestic programs. Should fiscal conservatives be sounding the alarm bells here?
I think they have been. Unfortunately, some of them, you haven't, sorry about that, you haven't heard from some Republicans because they've kind of become in the thrall of Trump. I think it was the senator from Nebraska, Ben Sasse, who said that, you know, that we have added money to the debt with really, like, it's no big deal, I think was the direct quote. And he's absolutely right. And the people who voted for this don't seem to really care about deficit or the debt because they just added to both.
So, Matt, some policymakers wanted more out of this spending bill, things like additional gun control measures or a permanent DACA fix. Those were largely left off the table when crafting this bill. Do you think those issues could have been addressed in this bill?
Yeah, I think Democrats should have held the line a little harder there on the protection for the Dreamers. I think that's the one that really hits people hard. And also gun control. I mean, the NRA seems to run Washington just as it runs Madison. And after all that's happened at Parkland and all over this country and with the big protests that the students are doing tomorrow, you would have thought that our elected officials could respond to their constituents and the sons and daughters of their constituents rather than the NRA. You know, the other irony about this whole thing is Republicans used to be for fiscal discipline, and now they just don't seem to care at all about it. So long as one of theirs is running the show, we don't need more spending on the Pentagon, $78 billion more on top of what is close to $700 billion to start with. And so, you know, I look at this agreement and just kind of shake my head. I mean, there, you talked about Trump's wall. He had wanted $25 billion for this wall, remember, that Mexico was supposed to pay for. And he only got, I think, close to $2 billion on the thing.
So this bill takes us to September 3rd. Then what, Matt?
Well, and then we have another go-round. I mean, that's the crazy way that budgeting is happening in Washington these days, that we just have these stopgap measures that maybe they last 3 months, maybe they last 6 months. But then we have all this frenzy about, are we going to shut down the government again? And that's kind of a crazy way to do business, too.
Steve Prestigard, what do you hope happens once this spending bill expires in early September?
You know, my honest hope is I hope the government does shut down. You know, federal, I'm sorry, but for that also. federal spend, the way that the federal budget is created is absolutely stupid compared to how Wisconsin's budget is created. Remember back in July, we had this sort of manufactured crisis in Wisconsin as well because there was no budget. Well, the fact is that since statehood in this state, if a new budget cycle begins, actually I'm a year off, it was back in 17, I think, but when a new budget cycle begins without an approved budget, you simply go by the existing spending levels. And we did that. The state did not fall apart. The state has never fallen apart when a new budget cycle starts with the budget not having been passed a new budget. They ought to figure out how to do that in Washington so we don't have this political theater going on every few months when, you know, we hear about, oh, the government is shutting down, when in fact that there is, you know, there's literally nothing that is actually central to government services that ever shuts down during the during an alleged federal budget shutdown.
Let's bring in Joseph now, calling from Rice Lake. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, this is so funny. The Democrats for 8 years were, you know, having this performance when the government was going to shut down that, you know, children would not get food and grandma won't get clean water. And now that the Republicans are doing it, it just seems a tragedy. When the Republicans add $1.3 trillion, seems like a tragedy, but when Obama added $9 trillion, that seemed to be, well, we needed to do that. So how do you square that circle, sir?
Well, it's easy, Joseph, and I appreciate the question, because Obama came on when the economy was crashing. And when an economy is crashing, it is crucial to save the economy to go spend more, go into a little bit of deficit spending. When the economy is doing well, as it has been the last couple of years, that's the time to see whether maybe you can cut into the deficit a little bit and have a little more prudence. But prudence is not the order of the day here in the Trump administration.
Joseph, thanks so much for the call. Let's move on now to the cabinet shakeup this week for President Trump. The president took to Twitter yesterday afternoon to announce that the former ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, will replace H.R. McMaster as national security advisor. It's been rumored for some time that McMaster would be replaced. Now that it's happened, Steve, what are your thoughts on Bolton replacing him?
Well, a couple of things. First thing is that given the fact that Trump was apparently, from what I read, was listening to Bolton more than he was listening to his own people, maybe he should have named Bolton in the first place, and we might have avoided a little bit of this political theater that's been going on. That's one thought. The other thought is I'm not positive, and I'm I'm a fan of John Bolton's, but I'm not sure that he spoke with complete candor when he made the statement that Trump wants people in this cabinet who are going to argue points and, you know, present different viewpoints and so on.
And Steve, he's been called a bully too. What do you make of that?
Honestly, given the fact that I'm paying his salary and I'm paying Trump's salary and everybody else's, I don't really care about that. The correct thing is whether or not the correct policy is taking place. And John Bolton was an appropriate critic of the Obama administration's foreign policy 8 years ago. I thought he did a good job as the UN ambassador by refusing to knuckle under to people who are not fans of this country in the short amount of time that he was the UN ambassador. I'm just not certain that what Bolton claims to be the case is actually the case with how foreign policy decisions take place in the White House.
Matt, you see the word hawkish everywhere in news reports that describe Bolton. Hawkish means advocating an aggressive or warlike policy, especially in foreign affairs. Are you concerned about Bolton's track record here, especially during the Bush administration? He advocated for the Iraq War.
Sure am. I'm certainly not a fan of John Bolton's. I'm kind of surprised that Steve is. I mean, this guy was the biggest cheerleader for the Iraq War. He wanted to go from Iraq to an Iran war, and he's been very belligerent as far as North Korea goes. He was one of the founders of the Project project for a new American century, this neocon doctrine that was getting us into the Iraq War in the first place. And so this is really bad news for anyone who wants to see sanity in our foreign policy and in our military policy, and who anyone who wants to see peace rather than war being the first impulse coming out of the cabinet.
So, Steve, as we enter this possible meeting that President Trump will have with North Korea with John Bolton at the hip, does that cause any concerns there?
Actually, I feel slightly better about it because I don't think that the U.S. ought to be dealing with the enemies of this country, which certainly include North Korea and certainly include Iran, from a position of weakness. Remember that Obama administration line, leading from behind? Where exactly did that get us? I don't want us to go into war in those places, but on the other hand, I don't want some tin pot dictator claiming, or some, you know, some Ayatollah from Iran claiming that they have defeated America in some kinds of negotiations. The Iran deal was a hideously, horribly bad deal for this country. And I think perhaps the best way you could look at this is John Bolton is the next step in undoing the legacy of the Obama administration.
Well, maybe. We'll leave that at maybe. Let's go rewind way back to Monday when President Trump was in New Hampshire, where he unveiled a plan to combat the nation's opioid epidemic. His message, it's time to get tough.
Because we can have all the blue ribbon committees we want, but if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
So Trump is calling for broadening education and awareness about drug addiction while expanding access to treatment, recovery efforts, but strengthening punishments for those caught trafficking drugs seem to be at the core of his message there. Matt, let's start with you. Is a getting tough approach needed to fight the nation's opioid crisis?
Well, I'm against the death penalty, period, so I'm against what Trump was proposing here. But if he's going to be consistent about executing lethal drug dealers, he might want to start with the CEOs of the tobacco companies who kill 480,000 Americans every year, or the CEOs of the alcohol companies that kill 88,000 Americans a year. You know, just executing more people is not the answer to these public health crises. We should deal with these situations as the public health crises that they are, and give people the public health assistance that they need, and not just pretend we're just going to line people up and shoot them.
Steve, do you see a clear plan here, and whether or not capital punishment is needed as part of this plan?
Well, whether or not it is needed, which is an arguable point, I think it's pretty clear that's not going to happen. And the reason is the 2008 Supreme Court decision that basically bans capital punishment for anything that doesn't involve, for a crime that does not involve death as a deliberate act. In other words, not to use the term in this state, reckless homicide. I don't support the death penalty either. And the reason, for totally different, I think, reasons from Matt, I don't trust government to have the power of life or death over us. I also do not trust government to not get it screwed up somehow. In addition to that, I am pretty positive that people who are making 20 million, I think that was the threshold that Trump mentioned, or somebody mentioned, $20 million plus every year from the illegal drug trade are going to be very deterred by the idea that they might be arrested and 10, 15 years later, they might be executed in the federal by the federal court system. That's one of the problems, frankly, with capital punishment, that it takes too long. And to be 100% candid about it, it's not used often enough. And if the 2008 Supreme Court ruling is the standard here, it's not going to apply hardly ever. The death penalty thing is really, frankly, just something that he's floated out to his base that I don't think is going to happen at all.
I mean, the other thing about the opioid crisis is part of it was the responsibility of the pharmaceutical manufacturers and the pharmaceutical distributors, and he's going to be executing them too.
You're with us for Week in Review. At the table this week, Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com, Matt Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and you, your thoughts on the give and take this week, 800-642-1234. Should federal policymakers consider more regulations for social media companies like Facebook? What about the ongoing Russia probe? What sticks out to you this week? Would you like to see Congress take up legislation to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment right here on the Ideas Network. Here we are on a Friday, and you're with us for Week in Review as we walk through the week's big stories. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're getting reaction from Matt Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and journalist and blogger Steve Prestigard. And your thoughts on the week's news at 800-642-1234. The delete Facebook hashtag appeared more than 10,000 times on Twitter within a two-hour period on Wednesday. Are you cutting the cord? What do you make about Facebook? Call in, email ideas@wpr.org. So it appears that Facebook could be in some hot water. This week, the Federal Trade Commission opened an investigation following the reports that a data analytics firm, one used by the Trump campaign, had improperly accessed names, likes, and other personal information about tens of millions of the site's users. Let's listen to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg addressing the situation in a rare interview on CNN.
This was a major breach of trust. And I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data. And if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
So, Matt, some are calling for more regulations on social media websites like Facebook to protect user data. Do you think that's needed?
I think it's needed. I think it was kind of a pathetic response by Zuckerberg, because after all, that's what Facebook is. He captures us, and then he gets to sell our data to marketers all over the country. I mean, anytime you go up on Facebook and you put a like in or you send messages out, people are tracking you, and companies are tracking you, and they're using that data. So, we're not customers of Facebook. We're the product that Facebook sells. And for him to say, oh, my God, this is a breach of trust, we got to protect people's data, is kind of laughable.
Well, Steve, that Cambridge Analytica story this week was certainly in the headlines. A whistleblower bringing this to our attention. What do you make of this data breach?
Well, the number one thing is, from what I understand, Steve Bannon was involved, which is about as surprising to announce that the sun is rising in the east today. The second thing is that once again, we have gotten a lesson. Apparently, we need to keep learning these lessons, that nothing that you do on social media is very private or private at all. This is probably more sophisticated in a marketing sense than you see in other areas, but a less sophisticated form of data mining has taken place before. And oh, by the way, the Obama campaign did the same thing as far as getting data from Facebook about its users, and nobody seemed to have a problem with that, or perhaps knew about it back in 2012. I don't think that the answer is more federal regulation of social media. That never solves anything and creates more problems. The answer is for Facebook's users to say, we're not going on Facebook anymore. You know, people vote with their feet. And when they start losing users and losing customers, that might get Zuckerberg's attention.
Let's bring in Nate in Milwaukee on this. Hi, Nate.
Hi, thank you. Oddly enough, there's a Wisconsin connection to Cambridge Analytica in the form of a longtime Republican operative that, at least according to an article out about this week, even had a New Berlin, I believe, a post office box as the address. Now, he worked for the Trump campaign, but before that, he also worked for Americans for Prosperity here in Wisconsin, and they've been active for a couple of years. And I'm just curious if he was, his New Berlin address, if he was interactive with Cambridge Analytica during the time he was at Americans for Prosperity.
All right. Well, Nate, getting very deeply into this story, and Matt, any insights there?
Not really, except that Americans for Prosperity, after all, is the Koch brothers group that operates here in Wisconsin. By some accounts of members of Americans for Prosperity or those close to it, say they have as many as 30,000 members in Wisconsin, and they are big spenders in Wisconsin's elections. But I don't know this particular connection that Nate's talking about.
Well, even as President Trump tries to push forward his agenda, the investigation into possible ties between his campaign and Russia, led by Robert Mueller, continues on. The president went on the offensive this week on Twitter. He, after a busy weekend, which included the firing of former Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, the president called out Mueller by name on Twitter, calling the investigation a witch hunt. All of this led to some concerns that perhaps the president was thinking about firing the special counsel. So, Steve, is all of this a witch hunt, as the president suggests? And does Mueller have a future on this probe?
Well, I assume he does have a future on the probe, because I think the blowback that Trump would get from firing Mueller would make what has happened to this point look pretty inconsequential. Of course, you know, there is sort of a moderate position here, which is for people who think that Mueller has been conducting, in fact, a campaign trying to bring down Trump instead of investigating what may or may not have taken happen, which is to retain the special counsel but hire a new special counsel. I will tell you that, and I don't necessarily consider myself to be one of these people, but Trump supporters have not had their opinion changed in the least by anything that has been revealed at this point about Mueller's investigation of Trump or anybody else in the Trump administration. There's really nothing opinion-wise that's been changed in that sense.
Well, meanwhile, John Dowd, one of the President Trump's personal attorneys, announced his resignation yesterday amid a shakeup of the president's legal team. So, Matt, should we be reading into that?
Well, I'm very concerned that Trump is going to go ahead and fire Mueller. The real basic question here is the president of the United States above the law? I mean, we have a special prosecutor here who is investigating the president and those around him to see whether there was collusion with the Russians during the election. And imagine if that sentence were uttered about a Democratic president. And then the other question is whether he's been obstructing justice. And for him to fire the special prosecutor who's investigating him, whether he's been obstructing justice or not, would be another instance of him possibly obstructing justice. And so then the question is, does Paul Ryan have the spine to start impeachment proceedings? After all, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says if Trump does go ahead and fire Mueller, it would be an impeachable offense. You know, what would Ryan do? Or are we going to have to wait to see whether Democrats get hold of the House of Representatives in November and then to see whether they have the guts to do impeachment proceedings? But if he does fire Mueller, Trump certainly should face impeachment.
Well, on Tuesday... go ahead, Steve.
Just real quickly, anybody who thinks Trump is going to be impeached and convicted is just incredibly naive. To be honest, and I think Matthew knows this, you have to have a majority vote in the House to start impeachment proceedings. You have to have a two-thirds vote in the Senate to convict. And there is no scenario that that is going to end up happening. Richard Nixon wasn't even convicted. So let's stop that right now.
Well, going back to House Speaker Paul Ryan, we do have some tape of that. He was asked about the president's online attacks on Robert Mueller and whether or not he'd support legislation to protect Mueller from a possible firing. Here's what House Speaker Paul Ryan had to say.
First of all, the special counsel should be free to follow through his investigation to its completion without interference. Absolutely. I am confident that he'll be able to do that. I've received assurances that his firing is not even under consideration. We have a system based upon the rule of law in this country. We have a justice system, and no one is above that justice system.
So House Speaker Paul Ryan there would not say who gave him that information. He did not answer whether he'd support legislation to protect Mueller. Steve, do you think the Congress should step in with any type of protections here?
I'm not sure about that, because I'm not, first off, in a general sense, investigators should be free to investigate until it does come to a point where they go overboard. It is entirely possible to offend the constitutional rights of a president. You know, the president has the same constitutional rights as everybody else, due process and all of that. I'm not sure we're to that point yet, and I think in a general sense that special prosecutors should be able to do their job. I'm not 100% convinced that that is the case in this instance. I'm also not really, to be honest about it, and I'm sure Paul Ryan was told that there's no consideration of the firing. I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to be the case, however.
Yeah, I wanted to go to the bank with those assurances that Paul Ryan got. So,
well, you are here on Week in Review. Journalist and blogger Steve Prestigard is with us, as is Matt Rothschild, head of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Getting your thoughts on the week's developments as well, 800-642-1234. With Wisconsin's unemployment rate hitting a record low of 2.9% in February, should Governor Walker and his reforms get the credit? How about the legislation that passed and didn't pass during this week's sessions? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Continuing on this theme on Russia, Russian President Vladimir Putin cruised to re-election this week, receiving 76% of the vote against several minor candidates. Many world leaders have opted not to congratulate Putin on the victory, as they see the election system there being rigged in Putin's favor. But President Trump, against the wishes of his advisors, reportedly congratulated the Russian president on the phone, calling this week and earning him condemnation by Arizona Senator John McCain, among others. Matt, your thoughts on this first.
You know, actually, I don't have a problem with this. The idea that the president of the United States should congratulate another foreign leader for another election win, a big election win, and poll after poll has shown Putin to be very popular in Russia for 15 years now. And, so, you know, Obama congratulated Putin when he won. You know, why shouldn't it, you know, Trump? And it just seems to me that if we do have less tension between Moscow and Washington, it's a good thing, because Washington and Moscow have 95% of the world's nuclear weapons that are still aimed at each other's big cities and on hair trigger alert. So, I mean, do we really want to be on that razor's edge all the time? And if Trump is just, you know, doing a common courtesy and congratulating Putin, I don't see anything wrong with that. I also think it was outrageous for his staff to leak the fact that, you know, he wasn't supposed to do it because they told him not to do it. I mean, he's the president of the United States.
Well, Steve, Dave from Madison called in on this. He says President Trump saying congratulations to Putin is proof that he is on Russia's side. Dave says he hasn't heard a better explanation. Do you have any insights there?
That's an incredibly simplistic answer. And as Matt pointed out, Obama congratulated Putin for getting elected 6 years ago. So does Dave think that that Obama was on Putin's side also? I tend to think this is about as inconsequential as a political issue that has taken place in this week, that, you know, there's important things that are taking place. This is not one of them. I think probably in some level, Trump is probably envious that Putin can get 74% or whatever it was of the vote, in what appears to have been somewhat of a sham election. But I think Matt's right that Putin is probably actually that popular with Russians and with the Russian voters. That's why he keeps getting reelected, even if he has the ability to prevent his most credible opponents from running in the race.
Well, point taken there. Let's move on then to some state business. Yesterday, a Dane County judge ordered Governor Scott Walker to call special elections for two vacant seats in the state legislature. The governor initially declined to call those elections after two GOP lawmakers stepped down to join his administration last year. And by doing this, both seats would have sat vacant for more than a year. Matt, let's start with you on this. Was this ruling correct in your view?
It was correct. It was an open and shut case. It was a scandal that the governor of Wisconsin was blatantly violating the letter of the law here and not letting people have representatives in Madison to represent them on issues. And Walker, the first time around when he said, well, the law says you're supposed to call these elections, said, well, you know, business is over in Wisconsin in the legislature. They've gone home. Well, they didn't go home. He called them back twice. And so there's been a lot going on here anyway that they should have been represented by with their people who win the special election. He needed to call special elections. Now, it's unclear whether he's going to appeal this ruling or not, but I just think this shows how anti-democratic small D Scott Walker is.
Steve Prestigard, your thoughts on this ruling?
Well, I guess there's, you know, the law is whatever the law says, I suppose. I think that I find it very interesting that nobody seems to have a problem with running a special election for a term that is going to be now significantly less. I mean, I guess from what I read, there could be a special election as late as May, and then probably a month later, whoever these people are, take office. And by the way, now 5 months later, they're going to have to run for reelection. There's never, when this happens, any concern about how much it costs to have county clerks counting votes, to have municipal clerks running elections. And I think as well, in addition to that, the reason that the Democrats push this is they think they can win these two seats.
So you see some wasteful spending here.
I think there is absolutely wasteful spending here. People who are claiming that they were not represented seem to either forget or ignore that we have two houses of the legislature, and everybody is represented by two people, one assembly representative and one state senator. I'm going to guess from what I read that the person who filed the lawsuit that believed that she wasn't being represented in the Senate probably didn't like the person who just left to go work in the Walker administration. Well, you know what? If I lived in Madison, for instance, I can guarantee you that I could live anywhere in the city of Madison and neither the representative nor the state senator would represent my views ever.
Matt Rothschild,
well,
your thoughts.
It's just a pretty blasé attitude about electing officials here to represent us in both chambers of the legislature. I mean, if we don't have our representatives in one of the chambers, that is a problem. That is a problem for democracy. We should be able to elect people both to the state assembly and to the state senate. And when there's a vacancy, that vacancy should be filled as required by law. There's nothing in the law that says you got to calculate how much it's going to cost for the county clerks or anything like that, or how much time is left on the term. The law is clear. Walker's got to follow the law. Walker hasn't been following the law, so he got slapped down by a judge, as he should have.
So Steve, does it come down to whether they should be following the letter of the law here, or should they look at the nuance of calendar because of the midterms coming up so close and the steps you have to take in order to call an election today in 2018?
There is a flaw in the system, and the flaw is and I got to be careful how I put this, the spring elections. You know, we have every November of even numbered years, we have elections for state legislature, you know, governor, U.S. Senate, House, and so on. What we should have instead of these spring elections is to have November elections in the odd numbered years for these nonpartisan positions for city councils and school boards and county boards and so on. Because we don't have that, we have this, you know, kind of weird hiccup where we have an election coming up in November, and then the following April we're going to have another election in like 5 months for these municipal positions, and then we're not having another election at all until the following April. And I think that that's a hiccup in the system myself. that we ought, that election day should be November in every year. And then if you know, somebody leaves the legislature to go work for state government, you have an election to fill that seat the following November instead of waiting this long amount of time.
We're moving through the week's big stories on this installment of Week in Review, getting your reaction to the local and national developments with Wisconsin's unemployment rate hitting a record low of 2.9% in February. Should Governor Walker and his reforms get the credit? How do you feel about the legislation that passed and didn't pass during this week's session? Join in. We can review 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist and blogger Steve Prestigard stays with us, as does Matt Rothschild, head of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. We'll be back for more conversation in just a moment, right here on the Ideas Network. With us on Week in Review, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Journalist and blogger Steve Prestigard is here with thoughts. Matt Rothschild with the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign weighing in. You can join in the conversation as well, 800-642-1234. How do you feel about what the state legislature passed this week during the session? Would a $100 child tax credit be beneficial to you? And what about the state's unemployment rate hitting a record low? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go back to the phones now. Anne is calling in with a development this week from Green Bay. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Well, I'm just wondering, this referendum question that's going to be on the ballot on April 3rd. About eliminating the state treasury position has not been talked about. It's been pretty quiet coming out of the state here. And I'm just wondering what you both feel about this and why it's being kept so quiet.
Matt, you first.
Well, I don't know why it's been kept so quiet. I do think this is an important issue, and I'm urging the listeners to vote no on this referendum. This would be a consolidation of power in the governor's hands, in the Department of Administration's hands. This is an elected office that's been in our Constitution forever, and the elimination of the state treasurer's position would be a bad thing. The state treasurer also participates in governing some of our public lands, and to throw that responsibility into the hands of the governor would just make the governor more and more powerful, and we've got plenty of power in the governor's hands here in Wisconsin.
Steve, is the referendum on the state treasurer's position on your radar?
I'm aware of it. In fact, I got something possibly from Matt or some other group that, you know, takes Matt's position. I favor its elimination. I also favor the elimination of the Secretary of State position. My grand idea for this is to take what authority is still remaining in those two positions, eliminate them, and give them to the Lieutenant Governor's office, and then have that voted on separately from the governor, which would make elections more interesting. But the point is that the treasurer hasn't done anything of substance, similar to the state, the Secretary of State hasn't done anything of substance for more than a decade. This doesn't just go back to Walker. They started losing their authority back when Tommy Thompson was governor. I am not in favor of paying somebody $70,000, which is, I believe, what the state treasurer and the Secretary of State make, to just sit in an office in the Capitol and do nothing except occasionally show up for meetings. So I absolutely favor their elimination. I'm voting yes on it.
And by the way, the state treasurer's referendum conversation, we'll be having that as part of the state capitol report on Monday. That is coming up after 7 o'clock on Monday. Busy week, though, for both houses of the state legislature. The Senate was called into action Tuesday. The Assembly gathered for an extraordinary session Thursday. Both houses voted to advance an $80 million juvenile justice bill, which, among other things, would close the troubled Lincoln Hills prison by 2021, replace it with smaller facilities. So, Steve, what you saw there, is that good use of money?
Well, I assume it is. I hate to say this, but juvenile justice is not necessarily one of the position or one of the issues that I think a lot of people get particularly interested in. Unfortunately, in small towns throughout the state and in large communities, we get to see the results when people who have misbehaved when they were juveniles end up as adults and continue and actually scale up what they do. I assume this is a better approach than what they've been doing. I'm not positive that that's the case, however.
Matt, we had indications that this legislation might have trouble in the Senate. What do you make?
Well, I think Walker and the Republican Party of Wisconsin and their leaders in the legislature understood that they had a real PR problem here with Lincoln Hills, and they wanted to get it off the front pages of the newspapers. I'm really glad that this passed, actually. It's a long time in coming. I want to salute Representative Evan Goyke and Senator Lena Taylor for working on this for years and years. Walker's former head of corrections, Ed Wall, had been suggesting some of these reforms, too, a long time ago, and it took Walker's fear of not getting reelected for him to move on this. All of a sudden, he got religion.
Well, let's, Steve, weigh in here. Was this mired in politics? Did politics have a lot to do with Lincoln Hills and getting to this point of closure?
Well, politics has everything to do with everything that takes place in Madison. I tend to think Matt's right that...
Is that a quote? I think I just heard a quote here.
Which part?
carry on.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, the fact is, he's correct that I think the bad publicity in an election year probably did have an issue. I think that Lena Taylor is one of the few Democrats, apparently, from what I understand, who is actually willing to work with Republicans in Madison instead of just, well, actually, she shoots off negative press releases also. But, you know, it is entirely possible that something actually good did come out of both sides working together, regardless of what the motivations for that were. It's remarkable how looming elections get people to move on political issues, isn't it?
All right. Well,
I hope you know that statement.
Let's also look at, there was this one weekend sales tax holiday up for debate, a $100 one-time child tax rebate, both items sought for by Governor Walker. Matt, are you on board with this?
Actually, I'm on board with this, too. I mean, it is kind of an attempt of Walker just to be handing out goodies before election time to say, look at me, I'm giving you everything you ever wanted, including a school back-to-school tax holiday. But sales taxes are regressive, and to give people a holiday on sales tax to buy school supplies, essentially, or whatever they want to buy in that period, it helps low- and middle-income people, and I'm for that.
Steve, are these just goodies?
Well, again, go back to that politics thing. You know, there's a phrase from Milton Friedman who said, and I wrote it down, I am in favor of cutting taxes under any circumstances and for any excuse, for any reason, whenever it's possible. I will say that $75 as a sales tax break for clothing and school supplies is really not a huge amount of money. It is amazing how well you can blow through money, and I speak from experience on this, but a sales tax holiday in this particular case is better than no sales tax holiday.
Well, let's take a look at the passage of this $100 million school safety package. It would be, among other things, creating grants for schools to upgrade building security. This is legislation that now heads to Governor Walker's desk, championed by the governor. Assembly Republicans also adopted two additional school safety bills on voice votes. One would require the State Justice Department to conduct background checks on long gun buyers. Steve, do you think background checks need to be a part of the equation here?
Well, I'll tell you that in the amount of time that passed, the people that I know who are on the political right are screaming about that. I'm not necessarily certain they're right. And some state representatives have been pointing out that one standard of background check as opposed to two different standards of background checks are not really expanding gun control. There's, as I understand it, they're just being more complete in background checks as opposed to this, you know, five checks for one and 11 for the other. And so I think that's the sort of thing, and again, to be politically cynical about the whole thing, it's the sort of thing that said, hey, look, we, you know, expanded background checks. But I do know that there's a lot of opposition to that on, not necessarily in the legislature. Again, there's an election coming up, but there is a lot of opposition among people who consider themselves supporters of Republicans.
Matt, what nuance do you see in a $100 million school safety package here?
Well, I don't think the Senate's going to go for that background check either. And I think it's horrible that the legislators didn't listen to the Wisconsin Sheriff's Association, which came out for a restoration of the 48-hour waiting period, or expanding it to even to 72 hours and having universal background checks on all weapons. That's what the sheriffs were for. And look, Scott Walker didn't propose anything to deal with gun violence. And there's a reason for that. Actually, there are 3.5 million reasons for it. That's the amount of money he benefited from expenditures from the NRA.
Well, data.
There is a reason for that, and the reason is that the Wisconsin portion of the 5 million NRA members, they vote on gun issues, and they have a very consistent position, believing that legal gun owners should not be penalized for the use of illegal use of guns by people who commit acts of violence. That is the reason. It's not about the money. It's about the votes.
Well, you're going to say money has no power in Madison? I thought you were calling me naive there, Steve.
I'm not saying that at all, but it's not the money that's the motivation here. It is the fact that NRA members consistently vote on for elected officials or candidates based on their position on gun issues. They are very pro-Second Amendment.
We got to move on here. Data released from the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development showed our state's February unemployment rate at a record low, 2.9%. Governor calling it on Twitter, saying our reforms are working. So, Steve, do you agree with the governor there?
Well, what was the unemployment rate when Walker took office? It was, I believe, 9%. I think that the unemployment rate is underreported by the feds and the state. The correct number is the U6 number, which is far, far higher. But when you compare Wisconsin to other states by the same standard everybody uses, Wisconsin is better than the national average. That has consistently been the case since Walker's taken office. That or not, the fact.
Matt Rothschild, record low, 2.9%. Final thoughts there.
Well, the national economy is booming, and so Wisconsin's economy is booming. I know Walker will take credit for it, but look at the middle class in Wisconsin shrinking faster than any other state. So, you know, while people may have jobs, their money in their wallets and in their bank accounts not so hot.
We'll have to leave it right there. Thank you both for joining us. Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com, and Matt Rothschild is executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. This edition of Week in Review was produced by Chris Molina and Keely Baltina. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend. Meet you back here on Monday.